Okay, well, maybe we'll get started. Well, no maybe about it. I mean, let's get started. So a few agenda items. We're all set for Tuesday for our tour of the VA. And there's a couple issues. I have the carpooling sign-up sheet here, so if there's somebody who hasn't signed up for carpooling or is a driver who would like to take other people, that list is in here. And there's also a couple of maps in here as well, if you didn't get one on Tuesday. And there's a Stanford issue. Stanford requires students to sign a waiver form on any of these tour events. So let me pass that around now. So this is just for people who are going on the tour on Tuesday. And just give it to me at the end of the day. Drew, are you going on Tuesday or not?
My class doesn't end.
Okay, all right. Well, I'm going to take some pictures, so for those who can't make it, I'll have some images you can look at. It looks like all the people who are working on projects have formed into teams and have sent me the composition of their team. I just want to make sure that you guys know how to proceed with your projects. If you have any question on what you should be doing now, or you get stuck, please contact me. You know, don't wait. You know, talk to me. Talk to me now. And I would like to get, you know, informal progress reports on what you're doing, so I know that you're doing something. Otherwise, you know, I don't know. So it'd be helpful if you just sent me a line or two of your progress. So that would be good. Okay. Next item. Oh, I don't think you need a handout. Here's the handouts for today's talk. And if any of you didn't get any previous handouts, I have a special sale on the old ones. They're discounted. Any new people who would want to get on the announcement mailing list, under the top pink sheet on the sign-up list is a sign-up list for community members. Come on in. So I might mention that all the lectures have been posted on Stanford Events. So we may see some different faces in the future. Okay, you know, here's the map again for getting to the VA. As I mentioned last time, Stanford's over here, and you take Unipro Serra past Page Mill, make a left turn on the Hillview. There's a stop sign, turn left onto turn right onto Miranda, turn left at the American flag, and this is where the American flag is. Parking area here. Entrance to spinal cord injury there, and once you get in the building, it's right, left. So that should be able to find it. So the on Tuesday, for those going to the VA, we'll meet in this room, have a tour, and then Dr. Graham Creasy will be giving us a short interactive presentation. So it should be a lot of fun. The most fun you've ever had at the VA will be next Tuesday. Okay, that's. Couple discussion items from our Who is Disabled list. A young woman has a devastating car accident that results in facial disfigurement. She has plastic surgery, and when the bandages are removed, she appears beautiful. But unfortunately, she lives in a close society of disfigured people. If you can figure out where I got this from, I'll buy you a coffee or tea or whatever is appropriate. Okay, nobody knows it. I got it from the Outer Limits, so it was in black and white when I was a kid, and I remember that. So Anybody have any thoughts about this obviously artificial situation, scenario, and the underlying issue I'm trying to bring out here? Shannon? You're always good.
I don't know. Instead. I guess, I would say at first, my first reaction after reading the whole thing is that maybe she's, in some way disabled. But I would have to know. I'm sure in Outer Limits that she was, knowing that show, that she was, alienated and everything. And in that circumstance, then maybe yes, I would say so.
Yeah.
Because also I'd have to know if she had, the plastic surgery willfully, or if she was just, rushed to the hospital and,
Yeah, I don't remember that part. I don't remember that part. And
so,
I think
a lot of that would actually, change my decision, possibly.
Yeah.
But just knowing that she lives in a closed society and disabled people, I say she isn't disabled.
She isn't disabled. Okay. Anybody else have any thoughts about this?
Well, I think that she sounds emotionally disabled. Which sounds a little strange, but
no, I didn't. I'm not talking. I mean, I'm referencing her, but I'm not telling you what she feels like. I mean, you can put yourself in her situation if you want,
yeah.
and if you did that, then you'd feel emotionally disabled.
If she's choosing to be in a closed society,
yeah.
There's something going on.
Well, that happens to be where she lives.
Now she's the outcast.
That's right. That's right. She's different. Everybody else has a particular appearance, and she has a different appearance. And to us, she seems beautiful, but in her society, in her universe, she's different. Okay, what if the situation were, you were in a foreign country, and you were around a bunch of people who all spoke Japanese, and you were the only one that spoke English, would you be disabled? Well, it's not a health condition, number one. It's a sort of a social condition, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's obviously temporary, because maybe, maybe you're there for a conference or something. You're not there for the whole time. But if you live in a closed society where there's no escape, that could be a little harsher, right? What do you think? I see some people nodding.
I'm not sure disabled is the right word.
Okay.
I would say handicapped.
Okay. Disadvantaged, would that work as well?
Disadvantages.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
So, it's a different word. Any other comments? Okay, I got an even sillier one. Superman sitting next to a piece of kryptonite.
Huh.
Well, is Superman disabled? I mean, he's different. He's got all these superpowers, and, in the comics, well, aside from the other superheroes, he's different, but in sort of a positive way. But now he's sitting next to a piece of kryptonite, and he sort of becomes a noodle, right? Can't move. Comments? What's going on here? What am I bringing up?
Well, does that mean you're allergic to something and you're disabled, kind of?
Okay.
It's like you put someone who's allergic to cats next to a cat, and then they start sneezing, they can't, or they can't breathe, or is that kind of what you're getting?
Yeah, that wasn't where I was going with this, but that's certainly a more practical case, and that's certainly a health condition. It's a health condition for Superman, and it's a health condition if you're allergic to cats. Owen?
I think there's a really interesting thing with the allergy thing, because that's a very easy one where you can get away from it if you know what it is. But if it's somebody who has some kind of health condition that might be an allergy-related one, where they can't pinpoint what it is, then they don't have that ability to get away from it as easily
mm-hmm.
as somebody would with cats.
This also brings up the point that you're disabled in certain environments.
Ah, in certain circumstances, right? So,
in the case of the violinist,
right. Yeah.
Volleyball, but when they try to find border control, if they're violent,
you know, there's a lot of other circumstances where, you know, you might be at a disadvantage or disabled. Imagine swimming with fishes. I mean, the fishes, it's their environment, and you're sort of an outsider. You got to sort of adapt to their watery environment, right? Outer space. All sorts of places where it's not healthy to be. I mean, hospitals.
That's not healthy to be.
Right.
Most hospital patients are at least temporarily disabled.
That's right. That's right. If you break a leg or something, you're in a cast for a while, you hobble around.
Surgery.
Yeah. So I'm bringing up, you know, the circumstance, and Shannon brought up a good point about allergies and the ability to possibly get away from things or not. I don't think Superman had enough energy, you know, when he was sitting next to a piece of kryptonite to pick it up and, like, throw it away so he can, like, cure himself. You know, here's one thing, you know. So, you know, his Clark Kent's secret identity was Superman. You know, but he was the only one in the comics with blue hair. And I didn't... I never understood why nobody recognized him. Clark Kent, Superman, they both have blue hair. It's amazing what you remember. Okay. So next Tuesday we have our tour. And I just want to make sure that everybody is taken care of as far as a ride or driving and stuff like that. If anything comes up, you know, please call me and I'll try to arrange something. And please... if you get lost or something, or you can't find your way when you get to the VA, just, you know, give me a call on my cell phone and I'll find you, okay? This ought to be fun. But today, we have Jessica Connor with us, and Jessica is currently working as an intellectual property manager and patent agent. In these positions, she writes patent applications, provisional patent applications, and office action responses, which I don't know what those are. She also conducts investigations for the patentability of new inventions. Jessica was with the Schatz Patent Group as a senior patent agent until last year. And Jeff spoke in the class last year. Okay, and she specialized in medical devices and in September of 2006, she graduated from Stanford Biodesign in the fellowship program, which is known for its intensive clinical immersion. Jessica and her team filed for 3 patents, received an NCIIA Advanced E-Team grant, won second place in the Stanford Business Plan competition, and were semifinalists for the USF and MIT 100K. I don't know what those are, but... Jessica received her MS in biomechanical engineering from Stanford and her BS, magna cum laude, in mechanical engineering from the University of Michigan. Go blue. And Jessica interned at IDEO in 2006, and she worked at Ethicon Endosurgery in 2004 and also worked at Stryker Instruments in 2003. So let's bring her up and have her talk about... Introduction to Intellectual Property and Interacting with Stanford's Office of Office of Technology Licensing. Here's the pointer.
Okay. All right, so hello, everyone. Thanks so much for coming down to hear me talk. I'm going to go over just a brief introduction to IP, and kind of based on where you guys are, we can either fly through this. Probably most everyone's heard at least the majority of what I'm going to talk about here, but hopefully you'll spice it up a little bit. And then also I think what will be really interesting for you guys is interacting with the OTL, that's Stanford's Office of Technology Licensing. So as inventors, if you guys come up with... you know, new inventions in this class around your intergroup projects and all that, what it's like to interact with the OTL. And I do want to say I don't work for the OTL. I never have. But I can kind of tell you what it feels like to be an inventor and work with them from that side of the fence. And so hopefully can shed some light and happy to answer questions along those lines. So we went through this briefly, but just want to touch on, I have spent some time at Stanford, and this was kind of the bulk of where my inventing went on, and in the clinical space around surgery and other medical device tools, and currently working as a patent agent at Shea Glenn Law Group, and there's cards up here up front if you guys have questions in the future. I've been working in patent law for about almost 5 years now, and before I switched over to the dark side, as we say, I was an engineer and have a lot of experience in the medical device area. All right, let's get started. So first I'll just kind of start off with intro to IP. So I'm sure you've all seen a patent. Hopefully, if you haven't, go Google one tonight and pull it up. This I just pulled off of Google Patents. They're kind of fun. They've put up some crazy, wacky inventions on their homepage. So this is a jumping snail, which is actually like an inflatable pool toy. But anyway, the important part of this is kind of what sort of things you're going to find on the patent, which we'll kind of get into in more detail later. But you've got, and this is totally blurry, but when you guys go home and look at your patents tonight, you're going to see things like inventor, the company they may work for, so who they've assigned it to, kind of all the references that came up or the classifications they've been in, and things like that. And so, and then we'll kind of come back to this as we go. So there's three main sections to a patent. We just saw kind of the bibliographic information that's on the top, who invented it, when it was invented, which is usually an important date to know. And then as you kind of flip through the patent, you'll get to what we call the technical section of the patent, kind of the meat and potatoes of what's actually going on. And that'll include the drawings and kind of paragraphs to kind of talk about what the invention actually is. And then you're actually teaching a reader of the patent how to make and use that invention. And what's interesting about the patent system and way back why it originally started is we need to encourage inventors to, tell us about their inventions and teach the public about what they've come up with. Because by, sharing this knowledge, then people can kind of add on to that and make improvements, and we can just have all the riches of everyone essentially kind of working together and feeding off of each other. So what's going to encourage them to tell us about their invention instead of just holding it secret so they're only one can do it? Well, we need to grant them a limited monopoly. And so in exchange for this limited monopoly, and as most of you know, it's about 20 years from the date you file your patent, you can have this monopoly. You're the only one, or you're the only one that can enforce making and using this invention. And so in exchange for that monopoly, we require them to teach us what they're doing. And then the last section is the claim. So if you flip all the way to the end of that patent, there'll be anywhere from 20 to 100 sentences that actually define the legal scope of what this document. So this is the really important part. That's what the attorneys are all going to flip to in the case and see what they're actually claiming in this invention. The technical section could go off on all these wild tangents, but this legal section, the claims at the end, is actually what the patent office will examine and what the inventor has considered their invention. So I have a question to all of you to kind of get us waking up and get us going. So who knows what the requirements to obtain a patent are from the patent office? There's maybe 5 or 6, but there's typically 3 main ones that you'll always hear about. Anyone have an idea? Or even if you just know one off the top of your head? Anyone? Yeah, Dr. Nelson? Yes, not obvious. So what does that mean, to us lay people in the audience? What would it be if it is obvious, actually?
I think it's a murky part.
Exactly, you're exactly right. Yeah.
It's what probably an expert I don't know if it's official language for
sure.
One practice. An expert in the field would testify to.
Sure, sure. Sure. Exactly. Great. So there's 2 other main ones. Anyone want to take a stab at it? Yeah. Yeah, so that you're kind of touching on novelty there, which is what our, kind of technical term for it is essentially you can't do something, exactly the same as what someone's done before. So yeah, it has to be substantially different. Okay, there's one more. This is kind of the easy one. Yeah?
Can you tell us
Exactly. And pretty much you can get, you know, through the patent office pretty easily on utilities. People are going to pretty much know, you know, as long as you can show some sort of use. The classic example of something that's not useful is a perpetual motion machine that just doesn't work. Great. So you guys got them all. So it has to be useful. You have to demonstrate utility. It has to be novel. So essentially it's not been known, described, used in this country or in a foreign country, or described in a either a patent or a publication, and not obvious. So essentially the difference between what's already out there and what you're trying to claim, so remember the claims are that legal section, needs to be a not obvious distinction between those things. Any questions on this? Probably, these probably all sound relatively familiar, right? We like to throw these words around a lot. Yeah?
What if you tried to patent something that wasn't workable?
Yeah.
You had, you know, a very convincing statement of an invention that just doesn't work. I
mean, yeah.
You gave the example of a perpetual motion machine. Mm-hmm. You can think of other things that obviously wouldn't.
Sure, and actually this happens a lot for, you know, two reasons, or two main reasons that I can see is that, one, the inventor just has this crazy idea, they're trying to protect themselves, and so they may actually file the patent application before they've done extensive testing. And so then maybe they later find, well, that embodiment of this invention doesn't quite work, but, you know, maybe something else. The other thing is that the patent office just does not have the resources to go in and, you know, they used to actually have a room where they kept all the prototypes and obviously had to stop doing that, so they just can't test. Does it actually work? We actually at work today were looking over a reference on how to clear out plaque from an artery. And the inventor was threading in a guide wire through the vessel and coming out the other side and then kind of pulling this loop through to just pull the plaque out. And we're all like, ah, I don't see how that could actually work. But he got a patent and then it was cited against one of our inventions. And so, yeah, there are, you know, these crazy ideas definitely do get through, sure, without a doubt. Another point there is, and we'll kind of get to this later with reduction to practice, is actually, and it's used in kind of proving inventorship, which I'll get into, but there's two ways of reducing your invention to practice. One is actually building a prototype, testing it, showing that it works, or if it's a method, performing that method and showing that you get the result you're planning on. But you can also, the patent office considers just writing up a patent document, reduction to practice. And so, you know, if you haven't tested it yet, you can still have a patent in there. And so just something to note, and I think I've touched on this, is that the claims are actually what define the subject matter. So when the patent office is looking at these three requirements to see if you actually have a patentable invention, they're going to be examining your claims. They're going to be comparing your claims to all the references that exist out there. And what, you know, us patent attorneys love is that you can pretty much write claims to get a patentable invention. It may not necessarily be valuable for your client, but if you keep throwing in detail, you know, if I'm patenting this laser pointer and it has a rounded end and the button is exactly a circle, you can probably distinguish your invention from everything else out there, but there may not necessarily be value. So there's kind of this give and take between a patentable invention and something that's still valuable for your client and company. Okay, so here's another one. So now we're going to start getting into the inventorship and ownership aspects of a patent, which I mentioned earlier. So who knows what some of the requirements are to actually be listed as an inventor? I'll give you kind of a scenario first. So if you, a lot of times especially, and maybe even in your, you know, groups here at Stanford, when you're working on a group project, you may have four people, or you host a brainstorming session, so you've got 10 people in the room and all these ideas are thrown around. How do you actually, you know, when a patent application comes out of that session, who actually, you know, technically and legally should be listed as an inventor on that patent? Anyone have some ideas of what might go into inventorship or requirements thereof? Anyone?
I mean, having the idea is, I mean, you have to define who had the idea.
Right. Certainly. And let's go with your word idea for a while, because there's, I mean, if you think about even just work at Stanford group projects, you go all the way from knowing what the problem is. So, you know, one of your people came in and gave you a talk on Tuesday and identified some needs. So there's all the way from that beginning to kind of forming some ideas, ooh, we could do this or we could do this, and then you kind of narrow in on one idea and you start building it. So there's this whole long process of, you know, product development and invention. And kind of where along that timeline is the moment that the patent office kind of gloms onto and says, okay, that's where you were an inventor. And it's that idea moment. It's that, here, I'll skip ahead here. So, and we have all these fancy words, but conception of the invention. So actually that moment where that idea was in your head. It doesn't matter. So if you come up with the idea and then you talk to Joe and you say, okay, I need you to build it like this and put these together, you're the inventor, and it's not necessarily that physical reduction of practice that it won't necessarily bring him in as inventor as well. Does anyone have any questions about being listed in as inventor? We'll go through a case study, and hopefully this will become more clear.
They do this in proportions. If one guy did like 90% of the work and another guy did 10% of the work, I mean, is that sort of figured into?
No, and actually that's a very interesting point, and I'm going to hold off because I have a whole core case to talk about that. But yeah, that would be fair. You would think that would be fair, but the patent office just doesn't have the resources and, you know, figure out, okay, he invented claim 3 and 4 and all of that. But no, that's a great point, and it'll come up later on. And so just kind of defining some of these words I had on the last slide. So conception is, as we were saying, kind of coming up with that idea, that the mental part of the inventive act. And you can't just come up with, you know, just part of it or, oh, here's the problem we want to solve. It's really, and as defined by our rules and laws, the definite and permanent idea, the complete and operative invention. So you could say, okay, here's my idea and convey it to someone so that they could build it without undue experimentation. So essentially you could write a patent application about, you know, what your idea is. Oh, and this is an interesting point. Dr. Nelson actually mentioned, so someone that of ordinary skill in the art, this will come up a lot. And this is a very vague gray area that we, exactly. Right. So, yeah, and, it, you know, attorneys like to define it and however's going to help their situation the best. But it we use this a lot to, you know, have you, you know, conceived fully of the idea that someone could understand it? And also going back to that enablement and that technical section of the patent, have you described it well enough that someone in ordinary skill of the art would be able to understand it? And, of course, that varies from art to art. If you are inventing mailboxes or, you know, a new way of putting a mailbox together, that may be less complex than, you know, quantum physics or, you know, MEMS devices or something like that. Okay, so now we've figured out who the inventors are, so they're going to be listed on that first page of a patent application. But then owners of a patent application, so who actually has the rights to enforce this patent application against others, may in some cases be a different situation. So who has a guess on who the owners of a patent application might be, or who has the right to own a patent application? Anyone? Yeah.
Follow the money.
True. Exactly. And so if they're paying the inventors, they probably had to pay the inventors for rights to this patent, for some, whether they're employees or anything like that. Anything else to add? We can skip on to the slide. So, yeah, starting out, the inventors will own the patent application. And in the U.S., the applicants, only inventors can apply, and inventors will own the application. And they will own it unless there is an agreement to the contrary. And so if you work for a company, you typically you'll sign an agreement coming in, I agree to assign all my rights over to you. And so you'll assign your rights over to your employer, and they'll be the owners of the patent. You'll still be listed as an inventor. You just won't own the rights. So you can't necessarily go and sue someone with your invention anymore because you no longer own it. Yeah. Yeah, typically, And they ask that you do just so that they can, I mean, they've got very specific laws to the timing on things, and if, you know, if inventors go crazy and just start assigning it to all these different parties who aren't necessarily working together, they have rules as far as, you know, if you registered this ownership change with the patent office, that first one will count as long as it's done within a certain time frame. But, yeah, it's typically registered, and if you get it on file before the patent issues, it'll display on that front page. But that it can also happen after the fact where it doesn't necessarily make it on that front page. So even if you don't necessarily see it, there may be different owners to that application as well. Any other questions on that? And so, so that's that same point. And to your question earlier is that say you have five different inventors on this patent application and they've not assigned their rights to the contrary, each of those five inventors will actually have full rights to the entire patent application. So even if, you know, if I'm joining on a patent application with three other people, and I came up with the idea of, well, let's add this clip on top of the laser pointer so you can put it on your belt, and maybe there's only one claim in all of the 50 claims in the patent application around this, I'm still listed as an inventor, and I actually have rights to the whole thing, and so I can license it off to other people and things like that. And so you'll typically want to, before the patent application is even filed, figure out, okay, who are your inventors, and what kind of agreement are we going to have amongst ourselves so we can kind of protect ourselves against things like this. And this will all become even more clear. I'm kind of jumping ahead of myself, so I have full rights to the entire patent. And when I keep saying rights to the patent, and another interesting wrinkle in patent law is that if you obtain a patent, so if you obtain a patent on this laser pointer, that doesn't mean you can run out and start making them and selling them and making $1 million. What it means is that you can actually, you have this patent on this invention, so now you can sue other people if they start making your laser pointer. But you can imagine, I mean, laser pointers have been around for a while. I think at least since I was in middle school, we'd bring them to school and point each other in the eye and get in trouble. But they've been around for a while. So there's got to be a lot of patents, and there's probably, you know, different laser technologies and different ways of configuring things and, you know, putting them all in. And so probably there, you know, you couldn't go out and just use this because you would be infringing maybe two or three other patents on a similar thing. And so just keep that in mind is that, and another example with medical devices, which you guys may run into with your devices that you're designing, is that, you know, you invent it and you develop the product and you get a patent on it, but then there's all the FDA regulations that you have to go through as well. And so it doesn't grant any rights to you as an inventor to go out and make it. It just lets you protect yourself from what your invention is from other people copying you or trying to come in on your market. Okay, so we're going to go through this court case pretty quickly. And just to give you some background so you guys can follow along and answer questions. So so trocars, this is kind of an older picture of them, but essentially for laparoscopic surgery, which is typically done in the abdominal area, they'll take these ports, and this is actually a skin layer right here. And these ports are actually typically about as big as this laser pointer, and they'll insert them in the patient's stomach, and they actually insufflate, so put air into the space and actually create an artificial surgical space. And then they can insert through these ports surgical tools or sutures or whatever maybe and perform the surgery without actually having to open up and create a large open wound. So back in the 80s or 90s, Yoon was an inventor, and he came up with a safety trocar. So essentially when you insert the trocar into the abdominal wall, you have to puncture your way through at first, as you can imagine, and then you get into this artificial space that you've created. But you don't want to keep puncturing through because there's intestine and other really, you know, important organs in there. And so Yoon invented the safety trocar, where once you pierce through the final layer of tissue, the blade retracts in, and so then you can be, you know, inside the area and not damage any tissue. So he invented this, gained a patent on his invention, and licensed it exclusively to Ethicon, which is Ethicon Endosurgery, who I actually worked for, but they do a lot in that kind of laparoscopic space. And then US Surgical happened to be infringing upon this patent for several years. back when Yoon was inventing this patent, he worked with, I don't have him on this slide, Choi, who did not have an electrical engineering degree but worked in that area as an electrical engineer and actually helped Yoon with the, because he wanted a signal to go off, or in one embodiment, a signal to go off once the trocar entered the site. And so these two worked together, but Yoon did not include him on the patent when he filed the patent because he thought, okay, this guy just kind of helped me build what was already my idea. And so you can imagine once Yoon and Ethicon together, because Yoon licensed the patent to Ethicon, brought suit against U.S. Surgical, and they've been infringing for several years, they've got multi-million-dollar lawsuit on their hand, they're going to throw as much money as possible at the situation, and they found Choi, which was their probably one of their happiest days yet. And so as it turns out, Choi went back to his notebooks, and he had some sketches of the work he'd done with Yoon. And it turns out that in one very specific embodiment that happened to have only one claim out of the over 50 claims that were in this patent application, that Choi helped invent one of the embodiments of the safety trocar. So, and I believe it was instead of the blade popping back in, a shield went over the blade. And then he also had some details in kind of the electrical signals and things like that. And so Choi actually in district court level was able to prove that he was an inventor. And he, as an inventor, or U.S. Surgical, talked him into licensing, well, you can license this patent to us, and suddenly we're not infringing anymore because we had licensed this patent to ourselves. And so the district court says, okay, yeah, you guys are right, Choi was an inventor, and we'll throw out the lawsuit because they gave a retroactive license back in the time. I've kind of skipped all ahead, but this is kind of one of the figures, 18 and 19, that showed Choi's actual invention, and he had sketches to prove that he had done this work and the date and all of that. I skipped ahead here of myself. He really, so now this is getting into the ownership. So the district court said, yes, he was an inventor, but we're still not throwing out the suit. Okay, so through that point, do you guys have any questions? I just threw a lot of information. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so that goes back to this idea of who's an inventor, right? So conception is that very important day. When did you come up with this first idea? And then can you show that you were actively working on it until it was reduced to practice? And in this case, either prototypes or writing the patent. So yeah, Choi, not only did he, you know, he couldn't just show notebook pages. Oh yeah, here, you know, I invented the signal here and this connection to that. They needed to be dated and probably witnessed and, you know, be able to stand up in court. And yeah.
But he wasn't actually
correct.
So how did he suddenly
become a co-owner? Because technically, by law, if you, you know, participated in the conception, and remember I had all those definitions, the full, indefinite, you know, permanent idea, you're an inventor. And, you know, you can go back at any time and fix the inventorship on a patent. And you're an inventor of the subject matter. And so that subject matter kind of follows you around. It may be in two or three different patent applications. But once you can prove, and especially since it was done in court, that you actually invented this material, you're an inventor. Yeah. Yes, yes, he could, but it was kind of, so the patent had been issued for, I just have several years up here, but you only have, I'm kind of getting into technical details, but you have a time limit on when you can go back after issue and change your claims around, and they'd pass that date, so there's no changing claims. Had he been smart and figured out Choi was an inventor up front, he certainly said, okay, he could have said, okay, patent attorney, he did this and this, I don't want that in my patent application, so let's make sure we only craft claims about what my specific invention was, and then none of this ever would have happened. But yeah, they passed the point in when you can actually go back and change your claims. Any other questions? Yeah.
Sounds like you could have a really important part of your invention not claimed.
Yes. Yep. Yeah, and, you know, there's lots of times where, you know, if you're the most important part in your mind may actually not be patentable. Maybe it's obvious, you know, that most important part, but in combination of other things you've done. And so, yeah, a lot of times, you know, claims need to be crafted around the prior art, what your invention is, and value and all those different things. And so there's always kind of a balance between those things. Okay, so they brought this from the district court all the way up. And so they said, well, you can't retroactively release someone from, you know, the damages they've essentially done to Ethicon. But, however, remember, all inventors have full and equal rights to a patent application. And so in almost, you know, in 99% of the situations, they can act independently. If Professor Jaffe and I are co-inventors on an application, you can license it out to them, I can license it out to Stanford, and then, you know, we go from there. We're both making money. But the only time you can't do that independently is when you're actually suing someone. Everyone has to get together and agree on filing suit against someone. So that's where this whole lawsuit fell down, is that Choi would obviously not agree to sue U.S. Surgical because he licensed it off to them, and they probably paid him a, you know, pretty good sum for that. And so because they didn't consent together, the suit was thrown out. And so you can imagine how painful this was for Ethicon and how probably pretty unhappy they were with Yoon that he hadn't gotten his act together and figured out all these inventors. Because if U.S. Surgical's infringing this patent for several years, and I can tell you trocars are a really important part of their business, think of all the money they lost, not to mention the millions of dollars thrown into this suit, especially if it went all the way up to this high level. So you can see where, you know, these important concepts of, okay, who actually is an inventor? When do we figure that out? Making sure we've included everyone and then kind of crossing your T's and dotting your I's before you actually, you know, get out there and start making these things so things like these don't fall out. Any questions? I know I kind of flew through that quickly, but yeah. Sure. I mean, and I don't know the specifics of who was talking to who and who knew about who, but I would imagine that once U.S. Surgical got sued, they kept Choi pretty quiet to themselves because he was their kind of secret ticket out of this lawsuit. But that's speculation. I don't actually know. Anything else? Okay. So we'll just do a little more review on that. So, and actually, okay, let's talk amongst ourselves for just a few minutes. And knowing what we just learned in this case and how things can go horribly awry, what lessons have we learned and what might you think about moving forward, whether that's inventing here at Stanford or inventing on your own in future companies? What things might you want to think about either before you even sit down to invent something or once something's been invented? So turn to your neighbors, take a couple minutes and chat, and then we'll kind of all come back together.
Thank you.
All right. Let's share with each other what we came up with. So who has a good one they want to share? Do you have one? Yeah.
I guess I'd say, like, ask people who they worked with and then try and look at everyone's apps and see everyone's notebooks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Totally. Anyone else? Yeah.
About an invention disclosure.
Yeah.
Where someone gets together at that point and agrees as to who's going to be signing the disclosure.
Great, definitely.
That's a first step.
Yeah.
Yes,
definitely. Yeah, and that's a great point, is the earlier you can handle these issues that where there's less at stake, the more willing. It's interesting. More people are more willing to kind of come together and talk fairly about things like that. So, yeah.
I think, too, probably by the time you get the patent application written and the claims drafted, it probably would have to go back and take one last pass and say, okay, now here are the claims that we're actually going to file, mm-hmm. or even at the point of... let's make sure that everybody who we originally listed as an inventor is actually an inventor on these particular.
Still is, yeah, definitely, without a doubt. And what, and another interesting point to that too is, as you mentioned at the point of issue, is that these patent applications typically, you know, going through those requirements, novelty, not obviousness, utility. The patent office will take typically 2.5 to 3 years to compare your invention against what's already out there, looking at those requirements. And you'll kind of do a back and forth with them. You know, you say, okay, I want these claims. They're like, no, you can't. You could have these. And that takes 2 years. And to your point is the claims will change over that time. And so inventorship could very easily change both ways. You may need, you know, may find you have to add someone in or take someone out, and that's quite a definite possibility. Anything else? Yeah.
It makes me hesitant to hear the inventor to actually ask for help.
That's true, you're right. I mean, obviously, collaboration is a wonderful thing, and we want to encourage that. And so you can often put agreements in place ahead of time where you say, you know, say you work for a company and you want to outsource the manufacturing of your product. Well, what you'll probably do is say, you know, either hopefully file, you know, a provisional application or, you know, first patent application before you work with them, or at least have some agreement of, okay, this is what we've invented so far. But now we want to work with you, and if we work with you and you guys invent stuff with us, great. We'll do a separate application with that stuff that we'll share. Or you can say, I really want to work with you, but these are all my inventions, so will you agree that you're not an inventor? Or if you are an inventor, that you'll assign your rights to me. Because of these agreements that come later on, transferring ownership, it doesn't have to be the fact that all inventors own all the rights. You can kind of create whatever agreement you want to kind of, you know, deal with that situation, because you do want to work with people and, you know, better ideas come out of it because of it. So, yeah. Ethicon, do you mean? The one that Yoon licensed his patent to? Yeah. I'm sure they did. If Yoon had a license, an issued patent, in theory, the patent office, if they're doing their job, they've gone through all the prior art and said, okay, these claims are patentable. And also, another interesting thing is searched for prior art, they wouldn't have necessarily found choice sketches. What they should have done is said, you know, and some things that I heard you talking about, who did you work with? What was the process you went through? What was each individual's contribution to this process? And, it, you know, they should have found Choi up front. An issued patent is assumed to be patentable, and it's actually is assumed by a court to be patentable because, you know, the patent office, in theory, has done a shot. Right. Yeah, and you know, they may have known about the Yoon patent. It's quite possible. any company will do a freedom to operate search where essentially they'll look at prior art and they'll say, okay, what is everyone else doing and can we actually make and sell ours without getting sued? And they may have found this patent. Maybe they knew about Choi from the beginning, or maybe they said, oh, no, we could get around this. We don't have to worry about it. So, I mean, there are times when companies will know about a patent and actually think they're not infringing, even if they may be. So, but, yeah, I mean, it's always better to know what's out there and do your searches on freedom to operate and patentability and, you know, before you license a patent, make sure you know everything that went into it. But, yeah, no, you're right. The more you know, the better, without a doubt. Anything else? Yeah, yeah. Sure. Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah, I mean, that when you get hit with a lawsuit, that's what you do. You say, okay, your first thing is like, okay, do we actually, you know, infringe this patent by looking at the claims? And if you're like, oh, shoot, we do, your very next step is like, okay, how are we invalidating this patent? And yeah, so, and by finding Choi in one sense, I mean, you can change inventorship, but incorrect inventorship actually does invalidate a patent. So that was one way of doing it. Finding prior art that kind of knocks out those claims would do it as well. So, yeah.
How easy would it have been for the U.S. Surgical just to tweak what you had done and just say this is not what you did, this is possible?
Yeah, so to kind of design their product around what that patent said. And, yeah, that actually happens all the time, which in my mind is kind of the beauty of the patent system, is because there's all these blocks and, you know, things you can't do out there. You have to be smart and creative and figure out a new way of doing it. And sometimes those new ways are better, or, you know, teachings in different fields and all of that. And so definitely. I mean, I think you can't know everything. There's over 7 million patents out there. You just can't know all the inventions out there. But had they known about you, and they probably would have done things a little bit differently. Who's to say, though? Who knows? Anything else? Okay. I'm going to we'll go quickly through this next part. So just here's some idea, or some areas where kind of ownership issues can come up. We talked about kind of relationships with manufacturers or other inventors, suppliers, things like that. And then also, which kind of leads us into the OTL university research settings, because there's often group projects going on. And as you all know, as students here and employees, we automatically assign our inventions to university. So just briefly on interacting with the OTL, and again, I don't work there. I'm no expert on what their policies or methods are. But just want to share some thoughts on, as an inventor, what's the best way to make your, at least what I found, to make your experience with them really great. And just to start off, their mission, at least when I last pulled this off their website, is to promote and transfer technology into society for use. And that's really what they want to do. They want to find the best home for these technologies, whether that's with the inventors or you're shaking your head.
I think they
want to
make money.
Oh, well, who doesn't, right? Who doesn't? But I do actually believe this. And interacting with them, I really do find it to be true. So I'm going to quickly go over their policies. I pulled these off the website so you guys can too. It applies to, as we said, faculty, staff, and student employees, so probably almost everyone in this room, unless you're in the outer community, and then you guys are safe. Stanford policies apply to work done while you're working here. And they have, oh yeah, I do have it in here, incidental use. That's their kind of, that's their gray area they've built in. And so, case-by-case basis, but when in doubt, talk to the OTL. Yeah. If you are not faculty, staff, or student, and most graduate students, are you undergrad student? Oh, I don't know. It's not, so they don't? Okay. Yeah, double check their website. But.
Something like a machine shop, a student operated a machine shop, they don't offer any guidance, but MIT allows their machine shop to be used by students and considers it incidental. So
it's very vaguely defined, purposely, I think.
Yeah, yeah. No, and it is, and it's, you know, all of patent law is almost confusing on purpose, just so you can kind of, particularly as an engineer, it was always tough for me, because I want a right answer, I want it very black and white, and I want an algorithm that I can follow to get to the right answer at the end, but patent law just isn't like that, and so bear with it, but that's kind of the beauty of it, too, is you can use it to your advantage and all of that. So for undergrad students and things that I'm not directly applying to, if you invent something while you're here, go talk to the OTL. If they have rights to it, they'll work with you and it'll be great. If they don't, then it's yours, and that's great. And so just when in doubt, go talk to them. Because you'd hate to find out later, like in the Yoon Ethicon case, that it was actually theirs, but you didn't assign it to them, and then it gets messy. So, yeah. Yeah, so they're actually, when I was just breezing through the website last night, and there are special sections on, you know, government or outside industry, if your fellowship comes to them, there are, I didn't read through those, so I can't tell you, but they do have kind of blurbs. And I have one of these slides, I have their website, so you can write it down. Okay, so, and it apply. Oh, here's the website. So patentable technology is mostly what we've been talking about, but keep in mind copyright, so whether it's software code or your, you know, novel you're writing or whatever, but that's kind of the last I'll talk about copyright, but just keep in mind that there are rules towards that as well, or policies. Okay, and then so this is just kind of, you know, when you do assign your rights as an inventor to the university, you still do get, you know, if your technology takes off and you're making royalties, you'll still see some of that back. The OTL starts with the cash they make. They'll take off some for administrative expenses, and then also they had any money they had to put in up front to, you know, apply for the patent or attorney's fees or all that stuff, they'll take that out. And then everything that's left, they'll split up into a third. So a third will go to you as the inventor. If there were four inventors, it ends up being like 11.5% out of the 33. And then a third goes to the inventor's department. So if you're a mechanical engineering student, your department will thank you. Again, to the School of Engineering or whatever that might be. Okay, so now here's the fun part. So the licensing process, so starting from your, you know, you've come up with this great idea, you want to move forward with it, so you fill out an invention disclosure, which is on their website, and you can actually do it online now, it's quite easy. So you'll send that in, and then pretty much immediately, they'll take a look at it, you'll talk to a representative over there. I'm going to go into more detail on the next slide about evaluation. But if they've decided, oh, this is great, we're going to move forward, they'll come up with a licensing strategy. You know, who could we potentially license this to? Who might be interested? Are they showing some interest? Do we need to talk to them some more? And kind of in parallel with that, they'll kind of, you know, is this worth patenting? Is it patentable? I remember one of my inventions, they were like, yeah, it's patentable, but it's a very narrow market. Your market's really pretty small. So they weren't sure if it was, you know, going to generate enough value for them to have it be worth their investment to patent it. So all different kinds of things go into that patenting decision. Again, marketing strategy kind of tied in with this licensing. You know, how are we going to market this? Who are we going to sell it to? If it's a medical device, how big is that patient population that you're helping with this device? Or, you know, how many people suffer from this disability that you're going to be helping with your invention? And then you'll actually license it out if you're so lucky. And then maintaining that relationship. So if you license this patent out, both the OTL and probably you and its inventor have a vested interest in making sure this company that you've licensed your technology to is really going to use it and not just shelve it. And that's something the OTL really looks for is, does this company actually want it because they want to make and sell it and, you know, help people with this technology? Or are they just buying it so that it's not a threat to them for their own technologies that they're more interested in? And so kind of all those things are all brought in together. Yeah. Yes, yeah, and they'll send you a nice little letter saying, no thanks, good luck, and then you can do whatever you want with it.
Mm-hmm. What is the rationale underlying that office's desire to make sure that the make sure the invention goes to someone who's going to use it. I mean, I understand actually making use of it. I understand from the royalty standpoint.
Sure.
But say there is a company out there who wants to license it, and they don't want to make it. They want it for freedom to operate.
Mm-hmm.
There's no one else that's shown an interest. What would be the rationale there?
Well, I would imagine if they're the only one that's shown an interest, they would rather license it to them than it go completely dead. But really, I mean, back to their mission statement, they really do want technology that's developed in the university to be helping people, and it can't help people if it's just sitting on a shelf. So they'll choose those opportunities over having it sit on the shelf. But I don't think they would just say, oh, well, if you're just going to not use it, we won't license you. But I don't know the firm answer to that, but that's my guess around that. Yeah.
Can you
Yeah, I mean, that kind of gets into contract law, which I haven't spent much time studying. But I don't know. I'm sure there are clauses that can be written in and things like that. But what they usually do is they build, so in this maintaining the relationship and in the actual license they'll draft up, is there'll be milestones that this person that's licensed it has to meet in order to keep the license. And so that's where they can kind of check in on, are they actually using this? And if not, you know, if it's they've done no development work on it, well, then they'll be like, okay, well, we'll take it back and try licensing it to someone else. You can also license technologies for, you know, non-exclusive or exclusive licenses within a certain industry. So if it's a, you know, a very broad kind of platform technology, you could grant one license to, you know, a company that wants to use it for heart failure products, or you could grant it to another company that wants to use it for, energy production or something like that. So there would be cases where you could actually license it out to multiple people. So kind of back to this evaluation step. So this is early on, and this is where it's your job as an inventor is to be, this is the greatest thing ever, and kind of really help the OTL see the value in this, and kind of start your relationship off great with them. So kind of keeping them up to date on where you are in the process. So the technologies I work on are medical devices, as I mentioned. And so you'll start off with an idea. You'll have a prototype. You'll start doing some maybe animal testing or some clinical testing in the hospital or something like that. So always updating the OTL on, oh, you know, today we found out in the lab that it's way stronger than we thought, and this is great. And so kind of updating them on the progress you're making, exciting things you've seen. And then also, you know, just letting them know who you are, what your background is, because a lot of times people are, you know, outside industries or investors come to Stanford, and they're interested in the technology, but they're interested in us as inventors and the brain power and the collaboration and everything that goes on here. And so if the OTL knows how, you know, great you are, and all, if you have this all these inventions together, that kind of adds value to your invention and to yourself as an inventor. Having a sense of where your invention stands up to the prior art, because as an inventor, you're probably, you know, an expert in that field, or at least have done a ton of research and kind of know what's going on. And so sharing that with the OTL, saying, you know, these patents might cause us problems, or I know this is our core patentable technology, we should go after that. And you're going to know things like that better than anyone else. And also kind of along those lines, the commercial potential and the licensing potential, you know your field, you know, okay, this is a heart, you know, heart valve. So I know the big heart companies, Medtronic, Boston Scientific, those are the players that are going to be interested. So we should be talking to them. And when I was working with the OTL, I went through and I created this list. And then they'll send out marketing materials talking about how great your invention is, who the inventors are, and they'll send it off to, you know, I gave them a list of 50 companies and they send it all off to them. And they have relationship with these companies. They have contacts there that know that, you know, Stanford's sending them cool stuff. And so the OTL is just a fantastic way of kind of streamlining this way to get your invention out to people, obviously not disclosing it to the world, but kind of, you know, making interest. Yes, yeah, which people, the outside world can come in and look. Yeah. The database of inventions? I don't actually know. I would guess you could. Can you? Yeah.
Yeah, I believe you can, at least.
I'm pretty sure.
I don't know if they changed that or not.
So, and I kind of touched on a lot of these, but just, I mean, it's an incredible resource we have at the OTL, the networks they have, the excitement for helping you get your technology out there and into the hands of people that can use it. Or, you know, if they choose not to patent it, they're excited to help you, you know, get off on your feet and do it on your own. And yeah. That's okay. It happens. I mean, I would say that the low percentage rate of the things they patent and the invention disclosures they have actually create money. I used to have numbers in those presentations, but they were out of date. But yeah, I mean, Google's one in a million, right? So I mean, it's a great experience and it's fun, and you've always got to take that risk. You never know. No. Nope. Any other questions on that? I think that might be. Oh, I have, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
As part of the marketing strategy, you want to have a trademark, any company, a trademark name.
Oh, okay.
Trademarking in parallel with the patents.
Yeah, I don't think that the OTL does trademark work, because that's actually that's a little later step. Is yeah, you'll want the name and all of that. As you're developing this technology, but that'll probably be post they've licensed it to you already and you're moving forward, yeah?
There actually needs to be either actual sales or there's going to be sales within, I think it's 2 years.
You're right, that's correct.
So you don't really want to do that until you're pretty sure that you're going to want it.
You're right, you're absolutely right. Yeah, you file your intent to use this trademark, and then you have like 5 extensions that are only about 6 months until you actually have to prove a total of 3 years.
Yeah,
okay, cool. Yeah, I don't do trademarks too much. So yeah. So yeah, that'll be probably later than what the OTL would work on. Yeah.
If you have an idea of something that you are keeping in the public domain,
uh-huh.
that you actually mm-hmm. what's the best way to do it? Is publish it?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the minute if you and I would probably talk to the OTL before you. That's actually another interesting element of university research settings is we're very much encouraged in publishing and getting it out there and collaborating. But there are reasons besides just making money and forming companies for patenting technology. You can protect the technology. You can prevent others from doing it incorrectly or using it in the wrong way. And so I'm a patent attorney, so of course I'm going to recommend this, but that you would think about patenting or at least talk to the OTL before you publish. Because the minute you publish, you're starting the clock on, can you, get a U.S. patent? The minute you publish, you can't get a foreign patent. And so it's really important to think about all your options before you publish. And you may not think, I don't think this is great. I don't need a patent. But, the OTL may think differently and want to patent it or help you do that. So always talk to them. Yeah. Oh, yes, there are a lot more attorneys. I don't know how many examiners they have. I know that they turn over really fast. I mean, a typical examiner is only usually there for 2 or 3 years. And they're usually, like me, pretty young. They only have, they have only been doing patent law for a while, usually not attorneys. And so there aren't nearly as many as patent attorneys. Anything else? Any other just general questions or you've been dying to know this one thing about patent law or interacting with the OTL? I can't say enough what a great experience it is if you are, interacting with them a lot. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. All right, patent law is broken. Everyone knows that. There's no denying it. I mean, the fact that it takes 3 years to get a patent out, and then once it's out, it's not even necessarily all that patentable, really. We all know it's broken. There was a move to change the laws last year, which would have affected how many claims you could have in a patent application, how many continuations. So if you file a first patent application, and then you either do a little more inventing, or you say, oh, well, that thing we talked about but we didn't claim is actually really important, So you can file another kind of subsequent continuing application. They were going to limit the number of those. They're going to limit, you know, you had to do your own searching in some situations, and you had to tell them about it. None of those passed. They all kind of froze. But there are still, I mean, there's always changes. And we all appreciate it needs to change. We're just trying to find the best way to do it. So anything else? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, no, that's a great point. So the a U.S. patent is only enforceable in the U.S. But you can't make it in China and then import it to the U.S. You can't do that. That's correct, yeah. And so that's why keeping your foreign rights are so important. So within your deadlines, you want to file U.S. probably, and then either a PCT application, which then down the line allows you to apply in any number of countries, or you can just pick and choose which countries. Maybe you know you're going to do your manufacturing in Ireland, and your biggest company base is in, or your biggest consumer base is in Great Britain or whatever. You may pinpoint those countries to file applications in. And China and India are interesting cases because their patent systems are getting stronger and stronger. Whereas before, they had no way of enforcing patents, so even if you applied for one and you got one, they would still kind of knock you off and couldn't necessarily enforce it. But their patent systems are getting better and better. And so really, we're starting to advise our clients to start applying for patents in those places as well. So, anything else? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Go ahead. No, I'm not being clear. No, you don't. I mean, that's the safest way to go. But you will probably, without a doubt, have agreements in place with whoever you're working with. But, you always want to be as safe as possible, and so having protection there is the best way to go, but not required. And, yeah.
Oh, just a little historical footnote.
Yeah.
Usually countries that are sort of coming into their own in terms of manufacturing and becoming a market force, often at the beginning of that period, they are sort of patent scofflaws.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of get into the patents and don't enforce them and don't require them. And then as they develop more of a vested interest in protecting their own invention, they will tend to be a lot more respectful of patents elsewhere. And the United States was in that position at one point. We were not very respectful of patents around the time of the Industrial Revolution.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So, very cool.
There's often an evolution, so we shouldn't be too superior.
Oh, no, and I hope to not have conveyed that at all, but yeah. And actually, yeah, I think early on in industry and when your country's just building, that's a great way to actually make income and learn these skills is, just kind of making things and buying and selling without restrictions on them necessarily. So, great. Anything else? Okay.
Jessica, thanks so much.
Yeah. Thank you.